Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, Truth. Well, welcome. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be, all around the world. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. Peter Slavinsky is with us. His website, www.oldschoolamerica.com. Peter, hey, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. You are the co-author of Old School America, which is also your website. And you suggest that conservatives have blown their lead. You, representing yourself as a conservative, have blown their lead in American culture twice in the past 50 years. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that when you think of the era before the Vietnam War, I think America was a fairly traditional country, a lot of emphasis on family and religion and self-reliance, the kind of things that would lead John F. Kennedy to say, ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. The Vietnam War energized a lot of people to be what was called being against the establishment, the anti-establishment forces. And the chief ones among them would be forces such as ones that wanted to liberalize our views of sexuality, say, and how sex was connected to child raising. And I think those forces were very well connected with the anti-war movement, and the anti-war movement was very justified, and it ended up helping a lot of those other causes along the way.
Well, let me just flip this around and get your take on this, Peter. It seems to me, I remember 1964, the year that Barry Goldwater ran for president. Now, there was, you know, the Vietnam War was not, well, it was an issue, but it wasn't like, you know, the big, huge issue. And I, in fact, I remember 63, I was 12 years old, and a friend of my dad's took me to a John Birch Society meeting. And in 64, I went door to door for Barry Goldwater. My dad was, you know, in the local county Republican official. And it seemed to me that there was somebody challenged. There was a very strong anti-establishment institution at that time, and it was called the conservatives. They were very, very anti-establishment. They were very concerned that, and this went all the way back to Joe McCarthy, and arguably you could say it went all the way back to Woodrow Wilson, you know, worried that the communists were infiltrating the State Department and everything else. I mean, this spanned Democratic and Republican administrations, and, you know, it just make sense to me that it all started with the Vietnam War.
Well, I think where it didn't start there, but the divide came there. So I think prior to the Vietnam War, Tom, I think you're right. There were terrific movements to liberalize our views on sexuality, to liberalize our views on the family, to liberalize our views on race. These were terrific movements. But
I think most people point the sexuality liberalization moment was the late '60s when the birth control pill became available.
Right, but what a conservative would say to that is that we could have had the pill and still retained the traditions and the connections that said sex and child raising need to be connected. That if you're going to be 18 or 20 and start having sex, you better be ready to raise children, because if you have children, you're responsible for them. That breakdown, the pill didn't need to break that connection down. And I think that was where the Vietnam War, the divisiveness, the anti-war movement, kind of splitting the establishment and the anti-establishment.
So are you suggesting that couples that are infertile shouldn't have sex?
Infertile. No, you can have all the sex you want, but if you have children, you need to be ready to raise them. And right now,
well, I think there's a consensus about that.
Well, Tom, if there's a consensus, though, how can you explain 50% of the children in America growing up in one-parent homes, and also the illegitimacy rates of single motherhood being, it's a third of the births right now.
Right, I know, and I know that, you know, conservatives are very concerned about this, and there's a lot of talk about this on the websites, but when you look at the actual numbers, you find that the vast majority of those births are among women who are in their mid to late 20s, and mostly white professional women. This is not, you know, it's being portrayed as, you know, oh my God, they're having babies in the ghetto kind of thing. It's not what's going on. What you're seeing is basically the people are waiting longer to get married, or they're having children without getting married, in some cases, in many cases, for economic reasons, because the middle class is being wiped out. There's this marriage penalty.
Well, Tom, if the single motherhood problem is only, or it's not a problem, and if it's just happening to women who are having children later, or women who can afford to have children, that's fine. But what this, have you heard these stats? It's something like 10 times that a child with a single, growing up in a single mother family, is 10 times more likely to live in poverty. A child in a single mother family is 8 times more likely to end up in prison. I mean, those.
No, I understand and I agree with those things, but a single mother family is different from a child being born out of wedlock. This explosion of children being born out of wedlock are children who are born into families where there are two caregivers. It's just that they don't happen to be married.
Well, we'd probably.
You're conflating two different statistics.
Well, let me try this one on you. What is the out-of-wedlock birth rate in black families? Because black families are possibly the toughest cases for poverty right now. 70% of the children born in black families are born to single mothers.
Black families are being torn apart right now in the United States as a consequence of the destruction of the middle class, the ongoing, ongoing institutional racism, the so-called war on drugs. People have no entrepreneurial opportunities, so they turn to drugs as a way to make a living. Or, I mean, there are a whole series of societal forces that are driving this. It's not just a matter of birth. But getting back to, you know, if we can expand the conversation just a little bit in the 3 minutes we have left, we're talking with Peter Slavinsky, his website, Old School America. You quote Russell Kirk extensively. Traditional and conservative philosophy grows from the conservative mind. Russell Kirk, 1953, he published this book, and it was the book that really got Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley and everybody else going. I've read the book, and Kirk's book in the conservative mind, first of all, he opens the book with Sir Edmund Burke. He just starts right off the bat talking about Sir Edmund Burke and, you know, how wonderful Burke was and, you know, everything that Burke said. But Burke was, you know, strongly of the opinion that society should have orders and classes, and that people who are, you know, he said, for example, the hairdresser and the candle maker, it doesn't bother him if they're allowed to participate in civil society, but they should have no say in governance.
Well, there are ways in which Burke is very aristocratic, I completely confess. The places where Burke's brilliance, I think, still applies today, and it's to anybody who would think of themselves as Renaissance thinkers, you need to go back. The Renaissance went back to the Greeks and the Romans and brought their brilliance back into the current times. Where I think
But Burke, that was liberal thinking, not conservative thinking.
Well,
the Renaissance was the birth of what we would call today liberalism.
Well, yeah, but it's going back for good ideas. And I will say I think today's traditionalists want to go back for some good things, like families and the emphasis on families. And I think progressives, if you want to, what Burke is saying, I think, is that you retain the wisdom of the ages, things that talk about things that we've learned over the centuries from our ancestors. And Burke's very big on religion and family.
And keeping things as they are. I mean, if Burke had his way, we would still have slaves and women would not be allowed to vote.
Well,
those were strong conservative values.
No, well, conservatism is holding on to what you have, but it is also changing when it's proven to be good. For instance, the welfare state, I would say, was a good try. Everybody wanted to give it a try. And
LBJ cut poverty in half in 4 years.
Cut poverty in half. But when
Condi Rice and Colin Powell, if it weren't for affirmative action, would not have the jobs that they have today.
But a lot of people give Clinton, one of the best things Clinton did was what's called welfare reform. A lot of kind of cutting back a little bit on the welfare state, trying to emphasize self-reliance and families taking care of themselves as opposed to the government kind of stepping in to get ready to take care of everybody. There's a way in which Renaissance.
I think that's a phony argument. Nobody is suggesting that the government should take care of everybody.
But a conservative point of view would be that we all should be so interested in promoting self-reliance so much in our children and our families that we want to go through life without having to depend on anybody
but
else.
But what about community reliance? What about we're in this together? What about a chain is only as strong as its weakest link?
Well,
what about what Jesus talked about in Matthew 25?
And that's a great point, because what Burke would say to that is the role of our religious lives, of our charities, our private charities. It's like the difference when you look at Central Park in the 60s and 70s, taken care of by the government, and now you look at it today, taken care of by a private charity set up to take care of Central Park. Central Park is doing better now than it was doing in 1975 in terms of its upkeep. Burke's emphasis is on the religious, the distinction.
So I think this is probably the main cleavage between conservatives and liberals, is that conservatives don't believe that one of the purposes of government is to care for the commons and the collective good, and liberals do.
And that's a good summary, except that I wanted to also make the distinction that we would believe in government doing that if it worked, but our view is that it works better when it comes from your family, your extended family, from churches, and from your own efforts. That when the government
Peter, we're out of time, but I get it, and I appreciate your being on the program. OldSchoolAmerica.com, the website, Peter Slavinsky. It's 16. Thank you for being with us, Peter.
Great talking with you, Tom.
Ditto. 16 minutes past the hour.
I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But while you swelter down there in your shelter, you can see me on your TV. While we're attacking frontally, watch Brinkley and Huntley describing contrapuntally the cities we have lost. No need for you to miss a minute of the agonizing Holocaust. Yeah!
And welcome back. Yeah, good old Tumblr. 21 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, the real free speech zone. Sue over in the chat room says, the best way to teach people self-reliance is to eliminate inherited wealth. Do conservatives support that idea? No. It's no. Russell Kirk, in his book, The Conservative Mind. By the way, before I continue with this, let me just share with you, on this day in history, today, this is the day that Franklin Roosevelt, actually it was the day after that he made this speech, but this is the day that it happened.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
And what's most significant about that is that we have now been in Iraq longer than we were in World War II. So the tragedy continues. Anyhow, Russell Kirk, in his book, The Conservative Mind, he writes about Sir Edmund Burke and all this stuff, and he really defined and framed the modern conservative philosophy in a whole variety of ways. He said, for example, that the starting point is a belief in God and a belief in an order that is more than human. And there's really two points to that. I think that it's possible to believe in God and yet also think that humans can do things for themselves, rather than thinking that everything must be, you know, it was basically a theological argument. He's basically suggesting that, well, in fact, here you've got a belief in God and a belief in an order that is more than human, which rules both society and individuals. In other words, society should be subordinate to religion. He went on to say, real progress consists in the movement of mankind toward the understanding of norms and conformity to norms. In other words, everybody should be the same. Real decadence consists in the movement of mankind away from norms and away from obedience to norms and authority. These are the key tenets of modern conservatism. And I'm trying to present them in a relatively neutral context. I mean, we need to understand this. For example, Russell Kirk believed that the so-called free market was a moral foundation of society. He said that economics cannot be separated from morals and character because material prosperity depends upon moral convictions and moral dealings. In Russell Kirk's world, there was no Ken Lay. Because at the time he was writing, you had Dwight Eisenhower, good conservative Republican president, who believed that there should be a 90% top income tax rate and that corporations that commit crimes should go to jail, or that, you know, corporate criminals, corporations themselves, should be dissolved. In this, he was quoting Edmund Burke in the 1790s, was, you know, the conservative thinker. He said, ordinary integrity must be secured by the ordinary motives of integrity. Men and women are industrious, thrifty, honest, and ingenious in an economic life only when they expect to gain certain rewards for being industrious, thrifty, honest, and ingenious. In other words, the only way that you can cause people to behave well is to provide them with some reward for good behavior. People are not intrinsically good. This is one of the core tenets of the conservative worldview. And I would say one of the core tenets of the progressive or the liberal worldview, the one that came out of the Renaissance and the one that came out of the Enlightenment, the one that caused the creation of the United States of America, is that, in fact, people will behave in an altruistic way. People will behave in ways that help other people, even when sometimes it doesn't serve their own best good, because the nature of people is to be intrinsically good. And that we don't need to have a society that is ruled by a religion, by a revealed religion. It's a wonderful thing to have religions within society. That's a fine thing. But not running society. Russell Kirk also, quotes Samuel Johnson. He says, a man is seldom more innocently occupied than when he is engaged in making money. Innocently occupied. As if making money in and of itself is a totally neutral thing. Again, look at Ken Lay. Look at all the crimes that have been committed. Look at our healthcare system right now, which is being mangled in the name of making profit. William McGuire just fired from United Health. I mean, after $2 billion in compensation, now the guy's the bad guy. And there's a piece about it in today's Wall Street Journal. So I think it's important. I think it's really incumbent upon all of us to understand the core differences between the conservative worldview and the liberal worldview, between the traditional European kingdom-based worldview, the conservative worldview, and the liberal worldview that came out of the Enlightenment and that caused the United States to come into being. 27 minutes past the hour.
Tag your ears. The president kicked democracy out the door and he shipped it off to a foreign shore. Giving birth instead to a holy war. I don't know why those Iraqis got so sore. We only killed 100,000 or more. It's called collateral damage when you're waging a war.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Herman here with you. It's always flattering when somebody writes a song, performs a song. It's got your buzz, your close phrase. What do you call it? Catchphrase in it. Anyhow, by the way, tomorrow, don't miss starting tomorrow, the first installment of my new book. I'm writing a book right now called Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. And in the third hour of our program, I'll be sharing with a conversation about it. With my editor, frankly, on this, and you as well, on this. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And I just, you know, from time to time, I think it's important to get into the larger picture of, you know, what is conservative, what is liberal, what do these words mean, what is the history of them, and how are they being distorted? At the same time, we have a lot of fear being promulgated in the United States, and a large number of terrorist incidents that have happened. In fact, let's see, you can count these as we go through. We'll just start after 9/11. Okay, let's see, October 14th, 2001. A North Carolina sheriff's deputy pulls over Steve Anderson, former colonel in the Kentucky militia, on a routine traffic stop. Anderson, who has issued violent threats against officials for months via an illegal pirate radio station, is an adherent of racist Christian identity theology, pulls out a semi-automatic weapon and peppers the deputy's car with bullets before driving his truck into the woods and disappearing for 13 months. Officials later find six pipe bombs in Anderson's abandoned truck and 27 bombs and destructive devices in his home. Is that a terrorist? It was not reported as a terrorist act. In fact, the guy apologized for his actions, pled guilty, and was sentenced to 15 years in federal prison. He was not prosecuted as a terrorist. Why? He was white. He's a Christian. December 5th, 2001. This is all post-9/11. Anti-abortion extremist Clayton Lee Wagner, who 9 months earlier escaped from an Illinois jail, is arrested in Cincinnati, Ohio. He'd escaped in February 2001. While on the lam, mailed more than 550 hoax anthrax letters to abortion clinics, posted internet threats warning clinic providers, if you work, I will kill you. In Ohio, he's sentenced to 20 years to serve consecutively on various weapons and car theft charges. Not considered a terrorist. This is, by the way, from the Southern Poverty Law Center, their intelligence report. Jewish Defense League Chairman Irving David Rubin and a follower, Earl Leslie Krugel, are arrested in California and charged with conspiring to bomb the offices of U.S. Congressman Daryl Issa, the Republican from California, and the King Fahd Mosque in Culver City. Was he called a terrorist? No. January 4th, 2002, neo-Nazi National Alliance member Michael Edward Smith arrested after a car chase in Nashville that began when he was spotted sitting in a car with a semi-automatic rifle pointed at Sheriff Israel Preschool, run by a local synagogue. In his car, home, and storage unit, officials find an arsenal that includes a 50-caliber rifle, 10 hand grenades, 13 pipe bombs, binary explosives, semi-automatic pistols, ammunition, and an array of military manuals. In one of his emails, Smith wrote, "The Jews perhaps should be stuffed head first into an oven," end quote. In the end, he's sentenced on weapons charges to 10 years in jail with time off for good behavior. Not charged as a terrorist. February 8, 2002, the leader of a militia-like group known as Project 7 and his girlfriend are arrested after an informant tells police that they're plotting to kill judges and law enforcement officers in an effort to kick off a revolution by whites in the United States. David Burkhart, who has a record for burglary already wanted for assaulting police officers, is found in the home of his girlfriend, Tracy Brockaway, with an arsenal that includes pipe bombs and 25,000 rounds of ammunition. Also found are intel sheets with personal information about law enforcement officers, their spouses, and children. Is he charged as a terrorist? No. He's convicted only of weapons charges. Draws a 7-year sentence. His girlfriend gets a suspended sentence for harboring a fugitive. July 19th, 2002. We're now, what, 8 months after 9/11? Acting on a tip, federal and local law enforcement agents arrest North Carolina Klan leader Charles Robert Barefoot, Jr. for his role in an alleged plot to blow up the Johnson County Sheriff's Office, the sheriff himself in the county jail. Officers find more than 24 weapons in his home, bombs, bomb components in the home of his son. He's charged with weapons violations and sentenced to 2 years. Is he considered a terrorist? No. In 2003, his wife and three other men are charged with a plot to murder a former associate. Another bomb plot. August 22, 2002, Tampa area podiatrist Robert J. Goldstein arrested after police, called by his wife, find more than 15 explosive devices in their home, along with materials to make 30 bombs, homemade C4 plastic explosive, grenades, mines, 50-caliber rifle, semi-automatic weapons, and a list of 50 Islamic worship centers in the United States. Is this guy considered a terrorist by the Bush administration? No. In the end, he pleads guilty and is sentenced to 12 years in federal prison with time off for good behavior. October 3rd, 2002. It just goes on and on and on. This incident after incident after incident. There was one on October 3rd. There was one on January 8th, 2003. January 18th, 2003. February 13th, 2003. April 3rd, 2003. April 10th, 2000. It continues. About every other month, there's been a terrorist incident, a major terrorist incident in the United States. None of them have been reported in the mainstream media. None of them. But we've all got to be worried about the liberals, and we've all got to be worried about the Muslims. While there are people among us who are actually trying to blow up our society and start race wars. 866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Stan in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Stan, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just wanted to add a little piece of data about the definition of a conservative. You were talking about wanting all people to follow the same general pattern.
Well, I was quoting Russell Kirk, who all the conservatives quote.
Yeah, you were mentioning that, and it just flashed that goes all the way back to Plato's philosophy, which has to do with the changing world is false and bad and evil, and only the world of the eternal forms is good, and so therefore.
Right.
Yeah.
For our listeners who may not be familiar with that, Plato had this concept, and you know Aristotle kind of fine tuned it, coming up with the idea of the atom essentially. But Plato had this concept that every form was actually a reflection of an what Jung would probably call an archetypal form or some sort of universal form that preexisted it. Another mountain. There was a mountain in the mind of God, for lack of a better phrase. Although Plato wouldn't have said that because he was not a deist. He didn't believe in a single god. He believed in multiple gods. So he was a polytheist. But that there was this perfect image of a mountain that existed in some other time and space, and that the mountain was the imperfect image, that there was a perfect image of man, and that man was the imperfect image, that there was a perfect image of a building, and man was the imperfect image, and our job always was to try to find, to fine-tune things to move toward that perfect image.
And
good point, Stan.
That filtered down through the church for ages and is still active today, as John Dewey called that the quest for certainty.
Yeah, and you could argue, I mean, you know, Jesus said, be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect.
Right.
And you could argue that in many ways, much of our modern revealed religions have been an attempt to find that perfect state.
If you look at the Muslims worshiping all in rows, all bow down in the same way, or if you look at the evangelist auditoriums with everybody holding their hands up in the same way, you get the feeling, and of course it's the same feeling we got with Hitler and all the Heil Hitler and so on.
But see, I'd say that's not necessarily a bad thing. You'd see the same thing in the wave at a football game. I think that there is an instinct among people, just a natural and probably on some levels healthy instinct, to collectively participate in experiencing things that are larger and bigger and more important than an individual.
Right.
And that's what I experience in church is a sense of you know awe and wonder. I mean it's frankly my most intense and real spiritual experiences don't happen in church, they happen in nature.
Yeah,
or they happen alone, but still I think people get that in those places.
I just want to say the difference is I think that if you're uniform with regard to some particular ideological goal rather than experiencing the spiritual community that you're talking about, that would be the difference.
Yeah, interesting.
Okay, well...
Thanks a lot, Stan. Interesting thought-provoking conversation. Jim in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great.
I was enjoying your show this morning, and it's interesting. Your subject kind of dovetails into something that was in the Eugene Register Guard this morning. There was a letter from a person in Springfield. Essentially, the tagline on the letter was referring to liberals as collaborators, and the thesis that he was covering there was that he felt that when the revolution comes, he's going to be ready to fight us. And I wonder how worried I should be about a letter like that and what steps I should be taking in my life.
These are the real terrorists, I'm telling you. The real terrorists are the survivalists, are the far-right guys who are you know, pipe bombs in their basement and hundreds of thousands of rounds of ammunition, and they're among us, Jim. They're among us. I mean, you know, they killed Alan Berg, the talk show host. They murdered him. Jim, thanks for the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Nancy Pelosi, San Francisco liberal. All the conservatives are all over it. All the media is all over it. You can't go another, well, I mean, it was a mantra for a week or two ago when Nancy Pelosi became the House Speaker, and they're going to crank it up again, I guarantee you. In fact, speaking with Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service last week, she was telling me how she had had lunch with a senior Republican elected official. In other words, a member of Congress, so the House or the Senate. She would not identify this guy. But somebody who has been elected more than once is a Republican. And he said that the Republican leadership in their caucus, the Republicans had gotten together and decided that they were going to block any kind of meaningful legislation in the last days of the session. They were going to dump as many disasters and as many hard choices as they could on the Democrats for January, for the first week of January. They're going to set Nancy Pelosi up, and also that they've been fudging the numbers for the last few months, particularly leading up to the election, on unemployment, on the true value of the dollar, on inflation, on the quality of the economy. They've been fudging all these numbers. And the week that the Democrats take control, the first weeks of January, they're going to release all these unfudged numbers. And the administration is, and then they're going to blame it. They're going to say, see, Democrats took control of Congress, and boom, we're in a recession. And now, here, you guys fix all this stuff. Here's, all these spending bills and all this stuff that hasn't been handled. And it's going to be a terrible mess. And the drumbeat is going to be Nancy Pelosi's liberal San Francisco values are destroying America. So I thought I'd learn a little more about Nancy Pelosi's San Francisco values. Tim Redman is with us. He's the executive director of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, a weekly newspaper in the Bay Area. Hey, Tim, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Happy to be here.
First of all, is Nancy Pelosi representative of the Bay Area values?
Well, she's certainly not a San Francisco liberal. And I think that both the right and the left need to understand this. Nancy Pelosi is a relatively mainstream Democrat, and she has been very, very cautious about her political positions. She's been very, very cautious about her agenda, and I think she's going to continue to be so. I don't think that we're going to see some kind of radical left-wing agenda out of Nancy Pelosi. I, as a proud San Francisco liberal, kind of wish we would, but I don't think that that's going to happen.
What would be, just the use of terms here is so weird, Tim, because, for example, in a country where we are the only country in the world, as the Wall Street Journal pointed out yesterday, that has this patchwork quilt of a healthcare system that's private and public and that, costs us twice as much as anybody else in the world and delivers half as much healthcare. 80% of Americans want there to be a national health care system, think that Medicare for all is a great idea. And yet, when a politician puts that forward, they're described as a radical liberal. I don't get it.
I know, it's kind of crazy, isn't it? I mean, I wonder why the president of General Motors, who is spending $2,000 a car on health care, isn't screaming for national health insurance.
He is,
I mean, it
actually
seems like a good conservative value. But in today's vernacular, yeah, these get described as liberal values because we're talking about the government taking over an essential public function, which in most countries it does. That, in most cities, the government provides water to the people. It does it pretty well. Most people turn on their tap and they get fresh, clean water every day. But the idea of the government providing health care scares people and sounds like a liberal agenda. It's actually, I think, a very basic kind of conservative value that we're going to have low-cost, reliable, affordable health care. But I don't see Nancy Pelosi pushing that. What did she put on her agenda for the first 100 days? National health insurance? No. She put on having the government negotiate with drug companies for lower prices. Great. I'm all in favor. It's a fine idea. But
that's
it's a relatively
step.
Modest, mild approach,
right,
rather than saying, let's get rid of the insurance industry and this hodgepodge thing and have national health insurance.
Right. She also proposes cutting the interest rates in student loans in half. That sounds like a fine idea, but why should we have student loans at all? Why don't we go back to like the University of California system was before Ronald Reagan took it apart and have free college education? If we really believe that the way to solve the problem that Tom Friedman dumped in our lap with global free trade is to educate our way out of it, why are we not investing in our young people in education?
Right, exactly. Why don't we, right, as you say, why don't we get rid of student loans altogether, which saddle kids coming out of college with, tens of thousands of dollars of debt? Why don't we just say, all right, the interest rate's a point or two lower, that's nice, but why don't we just say, let's use tax money to make education free? And that, of course, requires you to do something that I think is a traditional American value, but is now considered a radical liberal value, which is to tax the very wealthy, the very rich, and use that money to pay for public services.
But well, this was, I mean, you know, Thomas Jefferson started the University of Virginia as a free college. A free college, so that there could be social mobility in the United States, and anybody who had the ability, the mental ability to attend college could do so and could become anything that they wanted. And it was paid for by the state of Virginia. And that, and he was so proud of that, he wanted that on his tombstone instead of the fact that he'd been president of the United States for two terms. I mean, this is, these are, I think, frankly, strong American values. I don't want to make this about, you know, picking on Nancy Pelosi. I mean, the fact of the matter is that she's taking the positions she's taking because they're the positions that, that are at the moment politically feasible. And that's more, in my opinion, an indictment of a system where big money, like the big money from the health insurance industry, has so much political say that to say the obvious and the rational is political suicide right now. I mean, she is, for example, suggesting that we broaden stem cell research with federal funds, and you know, we do away with the Bush tax, so-called tax cuts. Actually, it's a tax deferral to our children and grandchildren.
Yes, she is, and I don't want to pick on her either. She is also the first woman Speaker of the House, and she did something very, very difficult, which is to get the dysfunctional Democratic Party all walking in the same direction, and she helped get the Democrats elected, enough Democrats elected, that the Democrats now control both houses, of the House and the Senate.
Yeah, she's done a brilliant job. So here's the question.
That is a tremendous accomplishment.
Yeah, so here's the question. How do we, you know, my experience has been that movements, successful, long-term successful social movements, whether it was, you know, the abolition movement or the suffrage movement or the anti-war movement or the civil rights movement, or for that matter, the movement to create the United States of America, the revolutionary movement, all of these movements always begin at the bottom up. They don't start from the top down. We shouldn't be saying, oh, Nancy Pelosi should do this or that. We should be asking ourselves, what can we do to support Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats in Congress in becoming more progressive in their behaviors?
Yes, we should. But we should also hold our elected officials accountable. And we should also say...
Well, that's one of the things we should be doing, right?
Yeah, that's what we should hold our... And we should say... And I try to say this all the time. We expect more out of Nancy Pelosi. We expect more bold leadership and ideas because she is out of San Francisco. There are lots of great ideas out there that aren't even that radical that you and I have been talking about this morning. We expect our elected representatives to be willing to say this and to not be afraid to take things on and to not be afraid to say, well, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the mainstream media are going to call this a bold and wild and crazy idea, but it really isn't. It really is a mainstream American value, and we're not afraid to take these things on.
Right. It's amazing how Newt Gingrich, you know, 20 years ago could come along with his Contract on America. And you go through the list of the Contract on America things, and I did this on this program once about a year and a half ago. We actually got the original copy and looked at the original legislation that was behind each one of the 10 points. Six out of those 10 points all pointed to one piece of legislation, which was a tax cut on the rich.
Yep.
I mean, literally, six out of his 10 points were tax cuts on the rich. And then there was the, you know, we won't serve more than three terms, you know, voluntary term limits and stuff like that, which nobody, you know, which was a joke. I mean, nobody was paying attention. Even Newt wasn't paying attention to. So, and yet the media didn't call him on that. They didn't say he's some kind of right-wing extremist or hey, this is some kind of radical whacked out thing. But if Nancy Pelosi or if Democrats in Congress were to propose some fairly rational things, let's do away with the cap on Social Security. It'll make the program solvent forever. If Bill Gates pays the same percentage of his income, his annual taxable income in Social Security taxes that I pay, it just makes common sense. And yet, politicians are afraid to do this. We need to be speaking out, don't we, Tim?
We need to be speaking out, and we need to be speaking out all over the country, talking about these issues and saying, this is the kind of thing that we expect. But I'm not going to let Nancy Pelosi completely off the hook because she is the leader of the Democratic Party now. And I think if the Democratic Party is going to be successful and is going to continue to hold power in Washington and is going to be able to field a strong candidate for president next time, we need to have some real good ideas. Because I'm afraid the Democrats have gotten so used to being in a reactive position and in a cautious position and in a position where they're afraid to do anything that will shake things up. And now that they're in power, they've got to come forward with a real strong agenda for change.
Well said. Tim Redman, he's the executive director of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, the website sfbg.com. Tim, thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure.
Good talking with you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Our number 866-440-8466, tomhartman.com. We'll be right back. Who knows? In fact, Bush making jokes about our guys dying, our young men and women dying in Iraq. I mean, this is you know, really and truly tragic. Making jokes about it. This is Bush and Blair here on CNN.
Nick Robinson, BBC News. Mr. President, the Iraq study group described the situation in Iraq as grave and deteriorating. You said that the increase in attacks is unsettling. That will convince many people that you're still in denial about how bad things are in Iraq and question your sincerity about changing course.
It's bad in Iraq. Ready?
Why did it take others?
Yeah. He's bad in Iraq. That help? Oh, man. Anyhow, the response, by the way, to Jim Baker, a spokesperson for the president, when asked if Jim Baker, James Baker III, you know, the Iraq study group, would be asked to stick around and help implement the study group's recommendations, said, and I quote, "Jim Baker can go back to his day job." End quote. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Brian in San Francisco, California. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Tom. Listen, I haven't heard
anything. By the way, before you get into it, what's your take on Nancy Pelosi? She represents you.
Honestly, I think she's just, I'm more conservative than what she stands for. And okay. I actually know somebody that worked with her, and her views are very, very liberal. I mean, liberal to the extent where there's just no understanding it from my point of view.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
It's kind of the opposite of what Tim just said. So
yeah,
maybe
I know.
She's doing something right if both sides are upset with her.
I kind of heard it, and I see. Yeah. You know what, Tom? I wanted to get your opinion on the Iman situation with U.S. Air. I haven't heard anything, and I've been following it up, and it seems like the police report that came out showed that it was pretty much a hoax. It was all planned out. That's what it said. And I wanted to get your take since you were talking about the threats to America. I personally think that stunt, along with a couple of others by some, you know, orchestrated maneuvers, are really undermining our security. And I just want to get your feedback.
I saw the reports that Drudge was pointing to, saying that these guys did this as a way of trying to get publicity and as a stunt. I frankly don't know if it's true.
I'm actually referring to the police report. I mean, it's online. It's at michaelsavage.com, and they have it. And the police actually put in their witness accounts and their own assessment that this just seemed to be planned.
Right, but those police reports are reporting the opinions of somebody, not the words of the people who are doing it.
I think that's the investigation. Are you saying that there wasn't an investigation then?
No, we don't know what the imams themselves said. We don't know what they actually planned. All we know is what people are saying they think that these guys were up to.
Well,
but here's the bottom line in my mind.
Line.
I think that they were there are in most airports, at least in most large airports, most international airports, there are chapels. You know, the one in Frankfurt, I've sat in a lot. I mean, there's one in Frankfurt Airport because I used to fly in and out of that airport all the time. And it's just a great place to just go and sit and meditate.
Did you know that one of the imams, Omar Shaheen, was actually a representative of the King of Hearts organization, which had its assets frozen by the U.S. Treasury?
Yeah,
I mean, this guy has ties to this organization that supports bin Laden. I mean, I understand what you're saying, Tom, but I think there's a bigger threat here than perhaps what's being shown on the media.
Well,
I think
maybe there is, Brian, and there's no doubt in my mind that if there is, that this administration is going to track it down. What I'm curious about is why you're not equally concerned about the fact that there's people being found, that there have been 15 or 20 of these incidents since 9/11 where people have actually been found. None of these imams were carrying, you know, 20, 30 pipe bombs and suitcase bombs and sarin gas, but people are being found all over the United States with that, and they all turn out to be white conservatives.
I place as much on them as this, but
then why don't you place that on Michael Savage or on the right-wing media and say, why aren't you guys covering the right-wing cranks?
I think we had 9/11 with airplanes and Muslims. I mean, these guys were I mean, come on, they were from Saudi Arabia. They were from the Middle East.
Tim McVeigh was not from Saudi Arabia.
I'm talking about 9/11.
And I'm talking about terrorism.
And I'm not disputing what you're saying, Tom. I'm saying I think it's equally alarming that we have these groups. But
not equally alarming in the media, and it's not equally alarming on right-wing talk radio, and it's not. And
you,
frankly,
you
I think it's
recently. Name me a conservative threat that we've had compared to these imams that they drew the media into this. And they started alleging that they were being discriminated and that they were being harassed. And it turned out...
No, the right-wingers are getting absolutely no publicity at all when they're doing these.
Can you point out to me one or two examples?
Sure. Just last week, Van Crocker was convicted in Tennessee for an August 25th, 2004 arrest. He had C4 plastic explosive and sarin gas. Sold some to an undercover agent. He's been a part of a white supremacist group since 1980. He said, quote, it would be a good thing if somebody could detonate these weapons in Washington, D.C. He was planning on blowing up Congress while it was in session. It was only reported in the local media in Tennessee. 27 minutes past the hour.
Someone told me long ago there's a calm before.
Toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com. We'll get you there. And I hang out there as well, particularly during the breaks. Dan in Olympia, Washington, you want to debate me?
Yes, sir.
Welcome. You are live and on the air.
I'm sorry?
You are live and on the air.
Oh, okay. Yeah, debate isn't quite the word I use. I told your caller, screener, that I'm a reasonable conservative. And so since I've been listening to your show for the past month or so,
mm-hmm.
and because I'm interested in other viewpoints, I thought maybe you probably don't interact with many reasonable conservatives. So
I try to. I thought our first guest was a pretty reasonable conservative today, actually. You know, but in any case, what you wanted to call and discuss a particular point of difference in our worldviews?
Oh well, the other day I heard you outlining what you would consider a progressive worldview, and one of the I think what I came away with the one of the major philosophical points is the idea of the goodness of the individual.
Yes.
And,
this goes back to Rousseau in the 1600s, in the 17th century, and the debates essentially it was done in writing rather than person to person debates. But the debates between Rousseau and Thomas Hobbes, Hobbes representing the conservative worldview that without what Hobbes referred to as the iron hand of church or government. That society would devolve into something that, as it was in ancient times, Hobbes believed, would be nasty, brutish, and short. And Rousseau, on the other hand, as they were starting to discover these Stone Age cultures around the world, as the Europeans were traveling, you know, out into other parts of the world, and there was all this talk about the noble savage. They were discovering that people who were living the way that people had been living for 10,000 years actually had pretty good lives in many cases. And was suggesting, no, Hobbes, what you're projecting is wrong. It's modern society lacking the tools of modern society, but still maintaining its hierarchical order. And that's not, you know, most Aboriginal and Indigenous societies aren't organized that way. They're organized in a more egalitarian way.
Right. I'm somewhat familiar with the historical basis of that argument, but more. What I want to discuss maybe just is a current application, because, you know, with any historical debate, it's somewhat based on our perspective going into the study. But it seems to me that the idea of the goodness of man in developing society is somewhat disproven, or at least contradicted, by a lot of the applications that progressives have. For example, with the idea of, you know, what a progressive would call perhaps corporate greed.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like at first they kind of, they put that corporation as, they think of it as an individual, the whole entity itself, and humanize it somewhat. But then
who's
they attribute...
the they who does that?
I'm sorry?
Who is this they that you're talking about?
Well, I'm making a generalization.
Okay, so we collectively, we as a society, personalize corporations.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And then, but when we do that, what we fail, I think, to see is that the corporation is made up of individual people.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, a corporation is a legal abstraction. Buckminster Fuller described corporations as legal game playing. And that's what it is. If I incorporate, and I have many times, and I have a corporation right now, if I incorporate, what I am doing is I'm going to the state, to all of us collectively. I'm going to you, Dan, I'm going to all of us collectively, to you, Dan, as well as to me and to Louise and everybody else. And I'm saying, please grant me exceptions from certain rules. In other words, make it so that I'm not actually responsible for some of my own actions. Give me limited liability. Limit my liability. And in exchange for that, I'm going to engage in an economic activity that presumably is going to benefit society. And that's the deal that we make in order to create this legal abstraction called a corporation. And I would submit to you that the corporate greed that I refer to is not so much the problem of the humans, it's the problem of the system. That when you set up a corporation, it used to be, prior to the 1970s and 1980s, there were a series of Supreme Court decisions about this. Prior to that, corporate, and particularly back in the 19th century in the United States and in many other countries in the world today, I mean, this is the way it is like in Sweden right now. This is the way it is in Germany right now. I created a Swiss corporation back in 1987, and Vertrauen GmbH, German and Swiss corporation. And in Germany and in Switzerland, you have to declare that the purpose of the corporation is to serve the benefit of society first, and then secondly, to make money. In the United States, the Supreme Court has ruled that if management of a corporation fails to, in all regards, increase shareholder value, they have failed at their fiduciary responsibility and thus committed a crime. And so corporations, first and foremost, have to be all about money. Now, when you have a biological system, for example, that says the only thing that I'm all about is growing, that's called cancer. If you have an individual who has a single focus in their life, the only thing that they're all about is accumulating money, or the only thing that they're all about is washing their hands as many times as they can every day, or the only thing they're all about is collecting as many newspapers as they can, and their house is stacked floor to ceiling with newspapers, we call them mentally ill. And so we've created these sociopathic entities, and yes, they're full of people, the people who get caught up in them, but I would say that the bad behavior is a consequence of an inherently flawed structure, not of inherently flawed people.
Right.
Your turn.
I see what you're saying, and as far as the corporation being looking at it from the perspective of how what it is according to the legal system is one thing, but I'm talking about more the philosophical side of the people in corporations. And I hear what you're saying also, that many of the decisions they make are based on the structure. In other words, the decision's already made for them.
Let me take it a step further, and tell me if I'm correctly anticipating your argument. I'm suggesting that people who are trying to accumulate massive wealth at the expense of other people like William McGuire, the guy from United Health, who earned $2 billion off our health insurance, right? It should have been going to heal people. Instead, the corporation is doing everything it can to prevent paying claims, and this guy makes $2 billion in compensation. That I'm suggesting that's, you would say that I'm saying that he's wrong, that he's bad, that he's evil somehow, and that blows apart my argument that human beings are inherently good. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, I don't know about blow apart. That's one example, and I don't hear you saying that.
What I would say is the reason why he's trying to accumulate all that cash, if you were to ask him, is because he wants to provide for his family, he wants to provide for future generations of his family, that even the most dysfunctional behaviors, by and large, on the part of dysfunctional people, have some sort of positive basis. That at the base, at the root of virtually all human behavior, there are obvious exceptions, there's a small percentage of people who are just profoundly mentally ill, but at the root of all behaviors coming from more or less normal people is the desire for some positive outcome. It may not be apparent. It may not be obvious at the beginning. It may not be obvious to all of us. In fact, it may even look totally dysfunctional. You know, the drug dealer. What's this guy? He's selling drugs in the hood. You know, what's going on? Well, he's trying to make enough money to pay for his family. I mean, you know, that doesn't justify it. But it helps you understand that people do things for good reasons, not for evil reasons. The conservative worldview suggests that people always do things for evil reasons, and we have to create institutions to restrain their inherent evilness. And that's what I reject.
Right. Yeah. And I don't feel represented by either your characterization of the conservative worldview or the conservative worldview that tends to be presented by conservative politicians, conservative talk shows.
Then you're not a conservative. You're probably somewhere in the middle, like most of us. I mean, I'm not a far leftist. I'm not a communist. I don't think the government should control the means of supply and distribution. I'm also not a conservative. I don't think that we should just, you know, let the wealthy run everything and have no government involvement in the marketplace.
Right. Either conservative or progressive tend to be pretty loaded words. But what I can define a conservative, myself as a conservative, because I believe that the Bible of the Christians is the absolute authority for man.
Okay, that means you're a Christian, but what does that have to do with conservative politics?
Right. I mean, No. But when I say conservative, I don't mean necessarily politically conservative, because some of political conservative policies I would consider liberal, yeah, and others I would, you know, consider.
Yeah, it's a murky soup, isn't it, Dan? Dan, we've got to run. We've got to take a break and pay some bills here. I appreciate the call, though. Thank you very much. And I hope you call again. We'll continue the conversation. 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People.
Just another poor boy out to fight a rich man's war. Bobby had an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue to the bone when he landed in Kandahar. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. A stack of overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now, he's still there, chasing ghosts and thin dry air. Meanwhile, back at home, the fine has come and took his car. It's just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.
And welcome back, 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones with us from the Talk Radio News Service, representing the British press, our official British press correspondent. Although you're a U.S. citizen, aren't you, Victoria?
I am a U.S. citizen, but I'm still a British subject.
Why is that?
Because you don't lose it.
Oh, really?
There's a special relationship between the two countries.
You have dual nationality?
I do.
Well, that's really cool.
It's very cool, except my theory about it is that if I ever get into massive trouble in some strange Central American country, neither embassy will help me.
Well, yeah, or both might want to put you in jail or take you off to extraordinary rendition.
Exactly.
Well, here was the British press today talking to George W. Bush.
Nick Robinson, BBC News. Mr. President, the Iraq study group described the situation in Iraq as grave and deteriorating. You said that the increase in attacks is unsettling. That will convince many people that you're still in denial about how bad things are in Iraq and question your sincerity about changing course.
It's bad in Iraq. Well,
so he makes a joke. Bush makes a joke. It's bad in Iraq. Does that help?
Yeah, he didn't like that question at all. He didn't like the questions from the British press.
It was exactly what you predicted yesterday. You said the British press is going to come over. They're going to ask Bush hard questions, and he's going to blow them off.
Yeah.
And so, amazing. So what came out of the Blair-Bush meetings? And you know, a spokesman for the president said, you know, when asked, is Jim Baker going to stick around to implement the Baker Commission recommendations? He's 79 unanimous recommendations. The spokesman for the president said Jim Baker can go back to his day job. I mean, what's going on here?
Is that what the spokesman for the president said?
Yes. It's right there. Right, the CBS News is reporting it.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, and Baker did say that we don't expect the president to take up all 79 of these recommendations. There are three key ones that we expect him to take up. But they also made the point, and they said this in, he and Lee Hamilton said this in testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee this morning, that this is not a fruit salad.
You know, what does that mean?
You don't pick out the bits you like.
So Lee Hamilton is saying you've got to take the whole thing, and Jim Baker is saying we expect him just to pick out the parts he likes.
No. They're both saying the same thing. They're both saying it's not a fruit salad, but they're both saying you've got to take the whole thing. You may not take all 79, but you've got to take the base of it. You've got to take the crux of it. You've got to take the gist of it.
Mm-hmm. And Bush is saying...
Well, the impression I got, and I was at the Bush-Blair thing, and as I desperately tried to stay awake in an overheated room, the impression I got was that he was at some pains to emphasize the new reports that would be coming out from State, the Pentagon, and the National Security Council.
In other words, we're going to have our own damn reports.
Exactly, and the ISG is going to be just one part, one cog in the wheel. And that the Pentagon is going to be putting forward the proposals. So I get the impression that these proposals will not be implemented.
So what's he going to do? I mean, we have our young men and women dying in Iraq. We had another, 10 in the last 24 hours?
Yes, a shocking number.
Iraqis are dying. I mean, we're finding 50, 60, 80, 100 bodies a day with bullet holes in their heads and drill holes in their arms and in their jaws. These horrific torture being, apparently the new in way of torturing people is with portable electric drills.
What do you do?
Pardon?
What do you do?
Yeah, I mean, what is Bush going to do? No, it's not what do I do. It's what's Bush going to do, because no matter who's in charge of Congress, I know that all the Republicans are running around going, well, what's Nancy Pelosi going to do now? She doesn't have any say in it. He's the commander in chief.
That's right. Baker Hamilton made the point this morning in their testimony that it was very important for Congress and the executive branch to work together, but they went on to make the point that Congress doesn't have the power in this game.
The one power that they have is to pull funding. That's the only thing that they can do is to defund the war. And they're not going to do that. I mean, it would be political suicide, and it would also be stupid. So it comes back down to, what's Bush going to do? And I mean, I thought it was interesting that the Baker-Hamilton Commission says, well, let's, in fact, Jim Baker this morning talked about I guess it was you who told me this morning. He said, let's bring these guys out just before the presidential elections of 2008.
Yeah, I've been talking about, whether I got that right, whether he was saying that or whether he was talking about how they didn't want to bring out the report before the presidential election of 2006.
Oh, I see. But there wasn't. You mean the congressional?
Well, I don't know whether I got it wrong.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, check into that. But I mean, the point is still the report says 18 months from now. 18 months from now is 6 months before the presidential election.
Exactly.
That's
it
a
is.
Pretty significant date.
It's a highly significant date, and one all of those people would have been aware of.
Yeah. Obviously. I mean, they were all political creatures. All the people on this panel. Interesting how this is all spinning out, shall we say. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. There's a lot more going on in the world, by the way, that we'll get into. John McCain, by the way, having a little bit of a flashback. And the three-day work week in Congress. That and your calls right after the news. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
So how is it shaking out, the haves and the have-nots? Who's winning, who's losing in America? How is the game being fixed or rigged, particularly in the post-Reagan world, ever since the Reagan Revolution in 1981, when everything started to change? In America, when the middle class started to unravel very quickly, when corporations started to consolidate, when the mergers and acquisitions mania became maniacal. Paul Krugman going on Fox News talking with Neil Cavuto, talking about the super rich. Well, actually, to use his phrase, the super rich are screwing America. I don't think he borrowed it from the title of my book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, but maybe anyhow. Cavuto calls him a liar. I mean, get this.
Here's what I'm saying you're doing. You are lying to people.
This is Fox News calling a professor of economics and a New York Times columnist, one of the most, frankly, thoughtful men in America. Paul Krugman's been on this program a couple of times. A liar?
That's what I think you're doing.
I haven't heard a lie yet.
This is Krugman's response.
Look, if that's the way you want to do it, I mean, fair and balanced all the way. Look, come on.
Yeah, if that's the way you want to do it, fair and balanced, yes. Well, in fact, here's some things for your consideration. And this really gets to the larger issue, which is, you know, really who's in charge here and who's playing the game and who's winning and who's losing and how and why. What are the structural problems behind all this? Julie Appleby writing in USA Today recently. Hundreds of entertainment industry workers in California and New Jersey who buy health insurance as a group are being hit with a rate increase that will raise some family plan premiums to more than $44,000 a year. Insurer Cigna will raise rates for members of the group an average of 82% in California and 65% in New Jersey next year. Under the new rates, the most expensive plan in California will cost a family $3,685 a month or $44,200 a year. Less expensive HMO plans will cost families $24,624 a year. In New Jersey, an HMO will cost $10,260 a year for a single person and $30,372 a year for a family. Peter Lee, head of the Pacific Business Group on Health, a coalition of large employers, said, quote, sadly, this happens to medium-sized businesses all the time, but they don't make the news. Cigna spokeswoman Gwen Dilday, says, no, I'm not going to make jokes about her name, says, quote, these rates that we are offering are market competitive. The article goes on to note health insurers are generally free to set prices as high as the market allows. The average cost nationwide for a family plan offered by employers was $11,480. That's our average. That's what on average in America we're paying for health insurance for a family, $11,480. And if you think just because your employer is paying part of it, you're not paying for it, you're wrong. We're all paying for it. David Rubin, who along with his wife Alice oversees the trust. This is a California Department of Managed Care trust. This is the Entertainment Industry Group Insurance Trust. This is the group that's getting whacked. He says, we're getting people who are dropping out, and we're getting people who are telling me they wish they could drop out, but no, they cannot get other insurance. Siri Feeney, a child textbook artist in Ventura, California, says her $425 a month rate is set to nearly double. This is really hard for me, she said. Some years I only make that much in a month. People spending 100% of their income on health care? Why? Why would this be? Well, it could have something to do with this. This from today's Wall Street Journal in the politics and economics section, Jeannie Cummins' article column. Democrats may be promising a clampdown on lobbyist freebies once they take control of Congress, but ahead of that push, party leaders are collecting lobbyists' checks while Democratic staffers angle for jobs inside their well-appointed offices. Verizon Communications, Inc. earlier this week sponsored a reception for newly elected Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. Illinois Democratic Representative Melissa Bean was the beneficiary of a Tuesday night fundraiser in the new Capitol Hill offices of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. In addition to retiring Ms. Bean's debt, Chamber Political Director Bill Miller said the reception was a chance for corporations and lobbyists who didn't back her reelection to, quote, meet her and see what a great representative she is, end quote. Yesterday, Illinois Representative Rahm Emanuel, mastermind of the Democrats' House takeover, pardon me while I puke. Anyhow, accepted donations at Sonoma, a trendy California Capitol Hill restaurant that features California cuisine to match the wine list for his leadership committee, a type of account employed by ambitious lawmakers to make donations and curry favor with their colleagues. Separately, Moses Mercado, the Democratic National Committee's deputy executive director, will soon be joining the Federalist Group, a lobbying group with close ties to the White House that went bipartisan about a year ago. Isn't that sweet? Burlington Northern Santa Fe Corporation's RailPAC this week reported donations to the centrist New Democrat Coalition. They're not even using the name Democratic in their name anymore. David Sirota points out correctly, and this is over at the blog at workingforchange.com, correctly, that really basically what it comes down to, even in the Democratic Party, is the party of the people versus the party of money. The Republican Party has become almost entirely the party of money. The Democratic Party is split, shall we say. On the money side, you have folks like Rahm Emanuel. I mean, I'd put him and Chuck Schumer and Steny Hoyer right at the top of the list. As David Sirota points out, Schumer, for instance, recently trumpeted a new report calling for post-Enron corporate reforms to be gutted. Emanuel was the architect of NAFTA, who used the prospect of his being in the majority on the Ways and Means Committee to suck corporate cash out of Wall Street. Steny Hoyer bragged on his website about starting his own K Street project. One of his legislative staffers served simultaneously as an official for his corporate fundraising operation. You got Ellen Tosher, Democrat from California, one of the most aggressive spokespeople for the Money Party, using her position to undercut major Democratic efforts to address core economic issues for the middle class. Joe Lieberman, funded with a massive infusion of K Street and Republican cash. I mean, this is the Money Party. Then you have the People Party. Those are the leaders of the Money Party. Then you have the People Party. Sherrod Brown, Bernie Sanders, John Tester, Jim Webb. This is the core group, David Sirota writes, of economic populists who defined the larger populist trend in the 2006 election. And believe me, the 2006 election was not about right versus left. It was about corporatism versus populism. And the faster the Democratic Party figures that out, the faster they're going to make it. This is why the Republican Party is using phony populism. The war on Christmas, for example, phony populism. Gay marriage, phony populism. Well, it's not actually phony. It's an appeal to the people, right? It's trying to rally the people around something. It's just, it has nothing to do with the real core issue of whether or not you can pay your rent and have health insurance, whether you're going to live or die in America. So the economic populists, the ones who are working on behalf of you and me, David Sirota identifies a few of them. Sherrod Brown, Bernie Sanders, John Tester, Jim Webb. Senators Byron Dorgan, Russ Feingold, Ted Kennedy, Dick Durbin. These are the leaders of the People Party. In the House of Representatives, George Miller, the Democrat from California, David Obey, the Democrat from Wisconsin, John Conyers, the Democrat from Michigan, Louise Slaughter, the Democrat from New York, and Henry Waxman, the Democrat from California. These are the populists. Marcy Kaptur from Ohio, Tim Ryan from Ohio, Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, Nancy Boida of Kansas, Bruce Braley of Iowa. These are the leaders and staunch critics of lobbyist-written trade pacts and the corporate party, basically. So here we have the leaders of the People Party and the leaders of the Money Party, and pretty much everybody else is a little bit of each one. And they're trying to figure out which way to go. John Kerry, for example, kind of leans toward being the People Party. He's figured out populism is good. He always, I think, at his heart really was a populist. Chris Dodd, Democrat from Connecticut. It's not quite sure. Which way is Chris Dodd going? It's hard to tell. Evan Bayh, he leans toward the Money Party. And he'd like to be president. Yeah, gee, what a surprise. Charlie Rangel, leaning toward the People Party, but maybe not. Barney Frank, leaning toward the People Party. John Dingell, leaning toward the People Party. Max Baucus, it's hard to figure out. Senator Hillary Clinton, hard to figure out. She goes both ways. We need to start holding these folks accountable. 16 minutes past the hour.
Till I go down. Till I go down.
Gonna have to take us out before we stop talking about this stuff. 21 minutes past the hour. Teddy Roosevelt speaking before the Ohio Constitutional Convention in 1912. A wicked big corporation is necessarily more dangerous to the community than a wicked little corporation. Here, people say, well, you know, okay, I hear all this stuff about, you know, health care and, you know, why can't we solve the health care crisis? We can't solve it because somebody's making money. Well, so what? People are supposed to make money. That's capitalism. Yes, you're right. But they shouldn't be influencing legislation that allows them to keep making money at the expense of the public. There should be a wall between corporation and state. Let me share with you a law that was on the books in every state in the United States throughout the first 60, 70, 80 years of this country. And that, in fact, oddly stayed on the books in Wisconsin until 1954. They just kind of stopped noticing it. This is the Wisconsin version of it. Every state had one that was slightly different, but they all said essentially the same thing. The law was titled Political Contributions by Corporations. And here's what it said. And this is the law that I'm proposing we should write at the federal level. And if we can't, every state should. Keep in mind, this was the law of the land in the United States for over 100 years. No corporation doing business in this state shall pay or contribute or offer consent or agree to pay or contribute, directly or indirectly, any money, property, free service of its officers or employees, or thing of value to any political party, organization, committee, or individual for any political purpose whatsoever, or for the purpose of influencing legislation of any kind or to promote or defeat the candidacy of any person for nomination, appointment, or election to any political office. Period. End of sentence. End of paragraph. That's the law. Penalty. Now, keep in mind, this was back in the days when $5,000 was a fortune. You could buy a house. You could buy two houses with $5,000. In downtown L.A., you could buy two houses for $5,000 when this was the law. Penalty. Any officer, employee, agent, attorney, or other representative of any corporation acting for and in behalf of such corporation who shall violate this act shall be punished upon conviction by a fine of not less than $100 nor more than $5,000, or by imprisonment in the state prison for a period of not less than one nor more than 5 years, or by both such fine and imprisonment in the discretion of the court or judge before whom such conviction is had. And if it's a corporation, shall be subject to a penalty then by forfeiture in double the amount of any fine. And if a domestic corporation, it will be dissolved. If after a proper proceeding upon quo warranto in either the circuit or Supreme Court of the state to be prosecuted by the Attorney General of the state, the court shall find and give judgment that Section 1 of this act has been violated as charged. And if it's a foreign or non-resident corporation, its right to do business in this state will be declared forfeit. End of law. That's it. That was the entire law. It worked very well. Thank you very much. I think it's time to bring it back. The problem is not that we have corrupt politicians, people like Rahm Emanuel and Chuck Schumer, who, you know, on the one hand are talking real nice to we the people, and on the other hand are saying to the corporations, hey, give me a little more money here. You know, Joe Biden, we're going to do our bankruptcy bill here. You know, slip me a little cash, would you? It's not illegal. I'm not suggesting that these guys are criminals. I'm not even suggesting they're bad people. I frankly have a lot of respect for Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer. I've never met Chuck Schumer. I've met Joe Biden. He's a decent guy. He's brilliant, in fact. He's one of the smartest people I've ever met in my entire life, particularly when it comes to foreign policy. I even think he'd make a good president. But the fact of the matter is he pushed for the bankruptcy bill. Yeah, he's from Delaware, and that's where all the banking corporations are incorporated, the credit card companies are incorporated. Why? Because during the charter-mongering era in the 1890s, when Ohio said to John Rockefeller, what you're doing is criminal, creating these trusts and running small businesses out of business, conspiring with the railroads. This is against the law. We're going to shut you down, John Rockefeller. And Rockefeller said, okay, what state will take me? And New Jersey said, well, you know, we'll do away with that law. And then New York said, well, we'll do away with that law. And Delaware finally said, oh, we'll do away with all the laws. You can create a corporation in Delaware to do anything with just one person on the board. And that's why half the Fortune 500 companies are incorporated in Delaware. That's pretty hard stuff to go up against. 27 minutes past the hour.
Went to the center to amend for a friend all the channels that have broken down. Now you bring it up, I'm gonna ring it up just to hear you sing it out. Step from the road to the sea to the sky, and if you believe what we rely on, when I lay it on, come get to play it on, all my life to sacrifice. Hey, oh, listen what I say.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartman program. Gas prices going up for the holidays. Sure enough, 8 cents on average right now. Typically, they don't rise in December, but, if you've pushed them down so you can get your Republican buddies elected, so that you can pass them more campaign contributions, so you can maintain your corporate and political control, then... So this is where it all falls apart. It's not about corporations being evil. It's not about people being evil. It's not about politicians being evil. It's about our having a system that is turning America very quickly into an oligarchy. into a form of government where you have a small number of very, very wealthy, powerful entities. In Mexico, it would be families. In the United States, it's corporations who are making political decisions that are affecting the lives of all the rest of us. And they're making those decisions in ways that are not good for us. It's just pretty straightforward. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Craig in San Jose, California. Hey, Craig, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. What's up?
I think my comment in question may fit very nicely with what you've just been saying. I would submit to you that the reason that most of our politicians are leaning towards what David Sirota is calling the money party is because all of our political campaigns are privately financed. If voters and citizens in America of any political stripe want to have our government be more responsive to us instead of big money, we need to have public financing of campaigns.
I agree. Let me tell you how it works here in Portland, Oregon. It's really amazing.
Oh, yeah, it's great in Portland.
Yeah, we just did it. This was the first year. And in fact, oddly enough, the city council pushed this thing through and then had to run on it. The first test.
Sure.
The way it works is, now keep in mind, this is a city of about 1 million people, more or less. I mean, the metro area, you know, the actual people in Portland who can vote. And in fact, I think it's probably just a little less than that. Probably not all that different from San Francisco. And the way it works is, if you can get 1,000 people to give you a $5 contribution and their name, you know, sign a petition. So you've got to get 5,000 people who are saying, yes, I will contribute $5 to your campaign and give you my name. And in other words, certify that these are real, you know, voters and real citizens.
Right.
Then the city gives you $100,000 to spend on your campaign.
I think the key there is that money that the candidate is getting has no strings attached and no favors owed to anybody, so that when that candidate gets elected, they don't owe any favors to anybody except the voters. And
that's right. And that's half of it. That's half of it. But here's how it played out. Eric Sten is on our city council, and he's the guy who originally got this pushed through the city council. And he had to run for re-election in November. And so there's this woman here in Oregon who was a state senator, Virginia Burdick, who works for a PR firm that has among its clients Enron PGE.
Uh-huh.
And Ginny actually has a very progressive voting record. She's a Democrat. She was in the state legislature. But, you know, now she's running for city council. The city is having this major battle with Enron PGE. It's no longer Enron now. They've spun it off. But PGE, it's a private utility. The city tried to buy it. They offered, you know, $4.5 million or whatever it was, billion, whatever, some mind-boggling amount of money. They actually offered more than the private entity did, and Enron refused to sell it to the city. That's a whole long story there. So she's working for the PR firm that's representing them. And so she's not at all progressive on this issue, in my opinion, okay? So she runs, and who's giving her money? PGE and Enron. So she gets $125,000 from them. So the city says, okay, if she's got $25,000 more than we gave to Eric Sten, we're going to give Eric another $25,000. That's how the law is. So for every dollar that Jenny got from her private corporate donors so that she could, you know, represent them if she got elected, the city gave a dollar to Eric and matched her dollar for dollar. It went all the way up to like $133,000 or something like that. And Eric won the election. And he won the election not only because he was able to match her dollar for dollar, but because that requirement that the city funding match the private funding was there. Every single time Enron wrote her another check for another 10 or $15,000, it was in the newspaper the next day. And we all figured out what was going on. You know, it's like, this is pretty obvious, you know, what's going on here.
And these matching funds provisions, which are in all the successful public financing systems currently in effect, like Arizona and Maine, where they've had it for almost 10 years now.
Right.
Sometimes people, when they first hear about that, they think, oh my gosh, it's going to break the bank. We can't have that.
It doesn't.
But what they don't understand is that, you know, having that matching funds provision does two things. One, you already mentioned, is it helps keep the playing field level. But the other thing that it does is that it really discourages the private sources from contributing money because they know that it's just going to trigger matching funds for their opponent.
That's right.
So the overall cost of the program actually ends up going down, and both Arizona and Maine have demonstrated that.
Yeah, and that was our experience here. And I think that this is absolutely the way to do it. And there are some politicians. I know Bernie Sanders has been talking about this for 3 years on this program every single week, every single Friday.
Well, it's a bipartisan issue. It's about good government. It's not about right versus left. Anybody who loves democracy can get behind this. You may have heard of the movement at the national level called just6dollars.org. The six is a numeral, by the way.
Right.
It's backed by former Democratic senators Bill Bradley and Bob Kerry. It's also backed by former Republican senators Alan Simpson and Warren Rudman. It's a nonpartisan issue, and they're working to try to bring public financing to congressional elections.
Right.
There's also a movement afoot in California that we lost the recent election, Prop 89, but I think that was mostly because voters don't understand yet how incredibly valuable this would be and how valuable it would be in returning government responsiveness to voters instead of to big money.
Yeah, I agree, Craig. And that's where we need to be going. We need to be going toward public financing of our campaigns. And frankly, I think the other thing that we need to do is we need to go back and say, listen, if you're using the public airwaves, then you have some obligation to air the stories about the candidates or the debates with the candidates, the television stations, radio stations, things like that, and newspapers for that matter, if you're going to continue to get fourth-rate postal rates. We have, we subsidize newspapers and we subsidize radio and television in the United States and cable systems for that matter. They use our rights of way. I'm not suggesting that all of their advertising revenue should go away or even most of it, but there should be more dialogue about the issues and less campaigning by virtue of 60-second sound bites. It's just, these 60-second ads are not good for us. They're not good for democracy. They're not good for America. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi, Tom. Amy Goodman had an interview with two of the six Muslims who were removed from the U.S. Airways flight last Wednesday.
Oh, back to our right-wing caller in the last hour who was trying to bait me on this topic.
Right.
Okay.
Well, anybody can check out her archives. It was from Wednesday, November 29.
And that would be at democracynow.org.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So this imam, Omar Shaheen, explained that they had just finished their conference with the North American Imams Federation on how to build more bridges with non-Muslims and be more open-minded. And Congressman-elect Keith Ellison was one of the attendees of this conference.
Mm-hmm.
So according to this imam, six of them went and got their boarding passes, and he was promoted to first class because he's an elite member of U.S. Mm. Airways, or he was anyway.
Right.
Then they went through security and into the waiting area, and because it was sunset time, they decided to pray, because they pray five times a day.
Right.
And they decided that only three of them would do it, so not to attract too much attention, and they did it quietly, and that is what raised the suspicion of someone. And when the FBI was questioning them, this imam said that they're not suspicious people, they're very open-minded, and you can call the governor of Arizona, everybody there knows about them. He's the chairperson for the police advisory board in Phoenix.
Right.
And this is a volunteer position, and he reaches out to communities, and he does presentations in federal prisons.
Yeah. No, I get it, Bonnie. I get it. He's a good guy. And that was my point. The police report that, that Savage is pointing to and that all these right-wingers want to get hysterical about, this is quoting people who are basically saying, this is what I hallucinated happened.
Yeah.
Maybe
you could interview the Muslim host from the Young Turks about what's responsible suspicion on the part of Americans, because he's moderate and he used to be a Republican.
Yeah, and interesting idea. Bonnie, thank you very much. Ted in Berkeley. Hey, Ted, we got to take a break here in a second. You had a quick point you wanted to make about Nancy Pelosi?
Calling about Pelosi and her stand, and I want to say here in Berkeley, my local Congressman Lee, when I call her, they seem bored and burned out, but when I call Pelosi's office, it's really, hey, how you doing? A very very interesting. What more can you tell me?
They
it
take
happens
you, they
over
take
and
call.
Over. I'm very impressed with Pelosi's workers, if that means anything.
Well, see, I think that that reflects her style, and that's why she's head of the she's the you know the most powerful woman in the world now, or will be in a few weeks, and that is that she does pay attention to what's going on, and she is and there's she's created a culture in her office, and hopefully she can create that culture in the party.
Amen.
So we'll see how it shakes out, but we all wish her the best. Ted, thanks for the call. Thanks, and for your kind words about Nancy Pelosi. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Be right back.
Just before our stock did tank, we sold and took it to the bank. The workers still got screwed. It was our intention to build the working dude right out of his pension. We're Enron when Dick Cheney needs power solutions. We are there to discuss, yeah, Enron. We gave Bush lots of big contributions. Now he's working for.
Tried to buy the election in Portland, Oregon. The triumph of capitalism. In an unregulated environment where you get to be the monopoly power company. I mean, how many companies have wires coming into your house to provide you with electricity? Only one? Gee. By the way, yesterday, our War on Christmas segment, Catherine DeBrecht, the interview with Catherine DeBrecht, and then the bumper music with the Capitol Steps, the little play on it and all that. Got an email here from well, I'm not going to say a name. I just listened to your interview with Catherine DeBrecht, where she presents her straw man argument about the war on Christmas. I am a school psychologist. In the last 6 years, I've worked in 2 different states, in 4 different school districts, and at about 16 different schools, all grade levels. I have never noticed a personal attack on Christianity or Christmas. However, one school district I worked for in San Diego did frustrate me because of its crackdown on all holidays. I want to point out that it was not the school district buckling under pressure from the lunatic fringe left conspiracy, but it was due to the Jehovah's Witnesses and other extreme Christian groups that were either offended by holidays in general or were specifically offended by the evilness of Halloween. So the school district made the decision to cut out all holidays. I don't think it was even to be nice and cater to these Christian groups, but simply a matter of economics. That's my theory. Schools get money from the government for each student in attendance. If on a certain day, say Halloween, a large chunk of students are at home hiding from classmates in costumes, then the district loses money for that day. And then she goes on to talk about this. And it's interesting. Interesting. The war on Halloween, I think, is more real than the war on Christmas. Let's take a quick look at what's going on in Iraq with the ongoing U.S. occupation of that country.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance. There are people on the fire.
Following our security and other developments in Iraq, as of 1100 hours Greenwich Mean Time on Thursday, this compiled by Reuters, Dateline Kirkuk, 5 U.S. soldiers were killed when an explosion hit their vehicle in Kirkuk province. The U.S. military said a total of 11 soldiers were killed on Wednesday. In Fatah, 8 people bunkering crude oil from a pipeline near that town, 70 kilometers southwest of Kirkuk, were killed in an explosion. 7 other people were arrested. In Najaf, U.S. and Iraqi forces arrested Faris Hassan, a leader of the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's Mehdi Army militia in Najaf. The police said one detainee had been captured during a raid in Najaf, but gave no further details. In Baghdad, U.S. Iraqi forces captured 15 suspected insurgents. In Baiji, U.S. Iraqi forces captured a sniper on Wednesday in that oil refinery city. In Baghdad, U.S. Iraqi forces conducting a raid on Wednesday in Abadan near Tal Afar detained 7 suspected insurgents. In Iskandaria, police found 3 bodies with gunshot wounds and signs of torture. In Baghdad, gunmen killed Basil Abdullah, the deputy chief of Al Sadun police station, along with 2 of his guards. In Riyadh, a roadside bomb exploded near a car and killed a person and wounded another in that town. And in other developments, in Camp Buka, a detainee died from natural causes on Monday in Camp Buka, operated by the U.S. military. So, what's going on? Michael in Antioch, California. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Tom.
Hey.
Hey, I'd like to ask you about what you were talking about before, about the laws that were in place preventing or at least...
banning corporate activity in politics. Yeah, by the way, that's from the appendix, or the, what do you call it, the footnotes to a book I wrote called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It's in the paper.
Oh, I read that book. I should have remembered.
Yeah.
I read something by Corton that said something about that, too. But the problem is they're sending the labor overseas now. See,
yes.
I'm thinking about getting a referendum to recognize that law again here in California. That would be great.
Yes.
But the thing is, wouldn't they just move the whole kit and caboodle overseas?
Well, we need to do away with these multilateral trade agreements and go back to a tariff system. I mean, a tariff system is what built this country. A tariff is where you say, okay, if there's a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes made in the United States, and you can make that same pair of shoes with 20 cents worth of labor in China, then that's fine. We can't stop you from doing that. But when you import those shoes into the United States, you pay an 80-cent tax when it crosses the border. And tariffs were so essential to building the United States that 100% of the cost of operating the federal government of the United States came from tariffs from the founding of this country until the Civil War, 2/3 of it from the Civil War to World War I, and 1/3 of it from World War I to the end of World War II. It was from tariffs. I mean, this was the way that we kept business here. And I think, frankly, we should have tariffs both on goods and on services, Michael. I think, you know, we need to take it even a step beyond that and bring these jobs back home. There's a call me a protectionist. I will embrace that label. There's a reason why countries protect themselves. Japan does this right now, and they're not, you know, outsourcing the job. China does this right now. Tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie, taking your calls as he does every Friday, and our first installment of Cracking the Code, the Art and Science of Political Persuasion. I'll be presenting that here on the program as I write this book for a fall 2007 release. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.